This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A lot of people first heard the name Jennifer Egan when her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2011. But Egan was not an overnight success. This was her fourth novel, and she published her first story in the New Yorker nearly 30 years ago. But she's kept innovating since then, including a short story written entirely in tweets called Black Box. Compared to that, Jennifer Egan's new novel, Manhattan Beach, is a kind of departure. It starts during the Depression, and it's about a girl who goes to work in a shipbuilding yard in Brooklyn during the Second World War. It involves false identities, a possible murder, and the mob. It's kind of an old-fashioned page-turner, but apparently that didn't make it any easier to write.
Jenny, I have to begin because Alex Schwartz's wonderful profile of you in The New Yorker begins with you talking about a subject that seems to be so dear to the heart of so many writers, which is how horrible it is to write, how hard it is to write, how if you could be doing anything else in this world, including running up a mountain barefoot, you'd rather be doing that than write. What is it about writing that's so hard if you're talking to people who are non-writers?
It's such a good question. One of the strange things about it is that I find that the horrors that I experience with each book, and they're usually temporary. There's one phase in each book that's usually really bad. And when I'm in it, I think it will never end. And then after it does end, I kind of start to forget it. So it's always a little hard, but I'm close enough to this that I do remember. The really bad phase with this one was when I had spent a year and a half on a first draft. Well, that's a very long time to spend on a handwritten first draft. Typed it up and read it, and I felt like what I needed to know and do to possibly make this book even passable, not to speak of something that might actually please anyone much, but just to make it anything better than an embarrassment, felt like more than I was capable of. So I think that there's a feeling of impossibility, a kind of no exit sense that the way back is just as long as the way forward, but you can't find your way forward. So and I think this is where the isolation of writing is really difficult because, you know, my husband's in the theater and I know they have down moments sometimes working on a show, but it's collaborative. So everyone's there to kind of bolster each other up and also just consult with each other about whatever the problem is. I hadn't really shown this to anyone. It was not fit to be shown. And so I was in the echo chamber of my own head contemplating what it would really mean if I actually just didn't have another book. And that quickly becomes, you know, because fiction has such a magical quality to it in the sense that I think none of us really knows where it comes from. It's like dreaming. Well, what if you just stop dreaming? There's no one to promise us that that won't happen.
So, but you've done it before. This is your fifth novel?
Yes.
And that doesn't give you any confidence that the next novel, this novel, Manhattan Beach, is going to be in any way anything other than a disaster.
You would think it would. I think the reason it doesn't is twofold. One is I do forget how much I worry about each one. And that's nice in that I embark happily on the next, but it's bad in that I forget that I may have been just that worried before and
like
it didn't work out.
Like forgetting the pain of childbirth.
Yeah, I think it actually, that's not a bad analogy. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is that my books tend to be very different from each other. And particularly what excites me is to try to really renounce what I've done the last time. And I really thrive on a feeling of of change, of almost being ripped away from what I know, that seems to be what kind of wakes up all of my nerves and gets me interested and excited.
But what brought you to this book exactly, Manhattan Beach? We're in wartime New York, the Second World War. How did the story start for you?
My books pretty much always start the same way, with an interest or a kind of inclination toward a particular time and place. So I guess you would say they begin with atmosphere. So as I thought about New York during World War II, I began looking at a lot of photographs like Fenninger and other kind of amazing atmospheric photos of New York at that time. And what was immediately striking was just the omnipresence of the waterfront. I mean, it was a port. And I had lived in New York for many years by then and barely been on the water or thought about it. And that quickly led me to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was a really important place on the New York waterfront. During World War II, it was the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships, period. It built 17 battleships and repaired 5,000 ships. I mean, it was huge. I had never been there, and I live maybe five blocks away.
Five blocks from your scene.
Yeah. So that was fascinating, and I visited it, and it was really thrilling to go there. It felt very secret and hidden and kind of decaying and old, but also full of new things.
You did a lot of interviewing around the Navy Yard, people of a certain age or people who are now gone. Did they suggest characters as well as evoking the scene of reality?
I think that there were all kinds of little details that came through from those interviews that I'm so indebted to these women, especially women that I talked to for. For example, there's a crucial moment when Anna makes a friend, and that friendship begins with Anna watching this very beautiful girl fall off a bicycle. And that was a scene that was described to me by quite a beautiful 80-something-year-old whom I was interviewing, and she described this incredibly embarrassing day. It had stayed with her all those years when she rode along a pier on a bike and then slid on some sand and only then realized that the ship that she was alongside was just lined with sailors and they were all howling with laughter at her. And she said she never rode a bike in the Navy Yard again. There are lots of little details like that.
One of the great parts of the novel is its bravura opening, which reminded me in some ways of Billy Bathgate, the way that there's a kind of great mob organized crime opening to a novel that stands on its own as this piece of exciting fiction. The thing that comes with mob fiction is a whole background of genre movies and television shows. Was that something that was in your wheelhouse? Were you a big fan of all that stuff?
Very much so. I love that stuff. I mean, and there's so much mob stuff going so far back. I mean, I love The Sopranos, but I also love the really early mobster movies. And I also have a bit of a familial relationship to some of this in that my grandfather was a police officer.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you come from
a mobster. Well, in Chicago, sometimes there's not a gigantic difference.
Exactly.
But I'm not saying that about my grandfather. He was real police, as they say. But what that means in Chicago might not be quite the same as what it means anywhere else. And it may not have been the same then as now. But my grandfather was President Truman's bodyguard when he would come to the Chicago area. My grandfather and his partner,
wow,
start dating back to before he was president, but they were all very friendly, and there are tons of lovely pictures of all of them laughing together. So he was interested. My uncle tells a funny story about watching my grandfather outside some kind of civic building, and my grandfather was sort of looking around, kind of a little narrow-eyed, and my uncle said, "What are you doing?" And my grandfather said, "Trying to separate the good guys from the bad guys."
If I remember right, isn't your book dedicated to?
It's dedicated to my uncle,
right,
Robert Egan, and to my siblings, because my father's no longer living. It is certainly my first attempt to connect to my ethnicity, such as it is, as an Irish American, because that side of the family feels its Irish Americanness very strongly.
You don't usually, so far as I know, as a reader, an ardent reader, use autobiographical. You're not that direct in the autobiographical sense. But here you've got a character, Anna's father, Eddie Kerrigan, who goes missing early in the novel. And your own biological father was largely absent in your childhood. How does that reality play with your creative work, if at all?
Since I feel like I'm very bored when I start to touch on my own life. It always sneaks up on me in my work, because if I think I'm working on that, I don't want to work on it. But I feel that that terrible feeling of familiarity comes over me, a kind of dullness. It just feels not exciting. It doesn't feel like an escape. And it, really, this all is a huge escape for me. I just love the feeling of being in two worlds at once, my life and this other life.
How did you first experience that?
I think as a little kid, I loved playing imaginative games with other friends where we just played characters and enacted sequences as those characters, and they went on over years. But there were other kids in our building, and I remember being pretty controlling. There was one moment where someone said, "I want to be the father," and I said, "No, the father died," interestingly, to your question. And the mother of this kid said, "Now, wait a minute. Why can't he play the father if he wants to?" So I was kind of pushy, but I lived for those games. I found them utterly transporting.
When did you start writing those games down, in a sense?
I was not really a serious writer until college.
You wanted to be a doctor.
I wanted to be a doctor for a really long time, and I loved science, and I loved biology. I'm still interested in all that.
But you've also gotten a reputation as a kind of, you'll forgive me, but a seer, somebody who makes predictions about things that are coming down the pike, about technology and other matters. Do you accept that?
I think that Jane Smiley used a phrase when I was listening to her speak recently called the energy of logic. I love that. You know, logic has its own sort of energy, and I think if you follow that, you reach certain conclusions that often do mirror reality because the logic is the same in both contexts. I've sometimes imagined things that came true, but usually so shortly thereafter that I'm not sure I really should get a lot of credit. I mean, you know, books take so long to publish that half the time the things have already happened by the time my book comes out.
Don't you wonder why it takes so long for the damn books to be published? I don't understand it.
I spend more time wondering why it takes me so damn long to write them.
I wonder how you feel about readership. I remember interviewing Philip Roth years ago. His overall prediction was that the audience for literary fiction, in a world where we don't just have one screen or one radio, we have proliferating screens, is, in his view, and he's old, is that it's become like epic poetry, or it's just become such a narrow, specialized readership. Do you get the sense that literary fiction is something that's winnowing and diminishing in its importance in the culture or not?
I don't know the answer to that, but I don't really ask that question because I feel like that's not a problem I can solve. The way I think about it is I have to write work that is of interest to those people, that synthesizes this same culture with all those screens, or gives us, I mean, this book is probably more of an escapist book. I feel strongly that if I do my job well, I will find readers. And that is a problem that seems more easy to tackle than a cultural problem about screens ultimately, you know,
which is beyond your control.
I mean, one thing is for sure. Fiction writers have to do an excellent job. That is the only reason people are going to read us.
Jenny, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan is the author of Manhattan Beach and other novels. You can find all the stories and essays she's published at The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. Now we're going to close the show today with a rare and exclusive peek into a forgotten corner of musical history. You may well know Roz Chast as a cartoonist. She's got a very recognizable style of squiggly lines and neurotic characters. Her book, Can't We Please Talk About Something More Pleasant, about dealing with her aging parents, was a bestseller a couple of years ago, and it won awards that don't usually go to books of cartoons. But here's something you don't know about Roz Chast. She and Patricia Marks, a staff writer here, play in a band. Not just any band. A band with an amazing musical pedigree. They influenced some of the biggest names in music in the 60s and beyond. But they were also a little too far ahead of the curve for the mainstream. So now, for the first time ever, Patricia Marks and Roz Chast tell their story.
I'm Patty Marks.
I'm Roz Chast.
And we are the Ooklier Meltdown. You may not remember us, but you probably do. We were very, very big in the 60s when we were the Daily Pukulelis. Now we're the Ooklier Meltdown, and we are coming back. We're practicing.
For our return tour as Ooklier or Ooklier Meltdown, because we don't know how to, we're still debating on how to pronounce it.
We've gotten some experts.
Yeah.
But even they don't know. So, eons ago, I was playing with Bobby Zimmerman. Bobby Zimmerman.
And I was with Joni.
You were with Joni. We were both too good for the rest of our band. It was very clear. I mean, it's the reason we got kicked out of the bands, really. Yeah.
Well, they were good also, but I felt like the way that they were good was a different way than we were good.
Well, we had personality. Yeah. They had talent.
Yes.
Which, okay, each to its own, right?
Yeah.
We were really, just didn't belong with them. We had kind of a
style. And nobody wanted us in their band. I would go up to bands like Iron Butterfly.
Yeah.
You know, Jimi Hendrix Experience. I went there.
I gave Joan Baez two ideas, which really made her. She was wearing, had a pixie haircut. I said, go long, Joni. And then when she began, she would just say 1, 2, 3, 4. And I said, Joni, what you should do is flip your hair upside down, the way your long hair, after you grow it, and just say, this song's for David. He's in jail doing what he thinks is right. And if you notice, that's how she opened all the time.
So we got together and we realized that we were very simpatico and we liked the same songs. They were all public domain.
We liked the same color ukulele.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So we formed the Daily Pukuleles.
Yes, and we got very big for a while.
Yeah,
that was,
we got very big and then...
But then Paul stole all our money.
Paul, our manager, stole all our money. We didn't have any, luckily, but...
He stole what we had.
He stole our money. Yeah, he stole all the money we were going to get.
Yeah. And that was when things did get bad, though, because then we had to go into rehab.
Mm-hmm. Which we liked.
We made ashtrays.
We have some of the ashtrays from rehab.
Yeah, yeah. We met some interesting people. What was our first breakout hit? Boy, it was a long time ago.
Was it Star Spangled Banner? Was it...
I thought it was Happy Birthday.
Happy Birthday, yeah.
Yeah.
We wrote Happy Birthday.
Happy Birthday to you.
Yeah, yeah, that was, it's so
and now that we've
universal,
made,
really.
It
because
is universal.
If you're alive, if you're listening.
Right. Well, except for the people who have unhappy birthdays.
That's true. I mean, I don't want to force, maybe we should change it to like.
Unhappy birthday.
Birthday to you.
Yeah, whatever birthday to you.
Whatever birthday, because, you know, you don't want to pressure anybody.
Mm, right.
It's like, you know.
Disappointed birthday we could do.
Yeah, neutral.
Neutral birthday.
Neutral birthday.
Yeah, have a birthday to you.
Yeah.
We're working on Wrinkle, Wrinkle, Little Face.
Yes, yes. Wrinkle, Wrinkle, Little Face.
Also, we're working
wrinkles
another...
Wrinkles form in every place.
Right. will you...
Wrinkles high,
lines
wrinkles
erase. You want to play something?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Should we play...
Camptown
Races, also called Camptown Ladies.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we should say that... We rewrote, and if you listen carefully to the lyrics, if you can hear them, you will see why. And I usually introduce it because I don't have a singing voice, but I have a talking voice.
You have a very,
very good talking
voice.
I was in a talking choir.
My talking voice can get kind of like panicky and screechy.
Well, okay.
So
this is On Your Mark, Get Set, Go.
Pay no copyright and the ladies make us sick. in triumph all the doodah day.
The end.
The end.
It was on our first album, Ocular Accidents, which was our breakout album, really.
Yeah. We had a lot of records.
Right.
Duck and Cover.
Right.
Famous Duck and Cover.
Learn Ukulele in Your Sleep.
You too can play ukulele.
But not as well as we can.
Yeah. That was the subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
How to Make Love to a Man with a Ukulele.
Right. That wasn't Beethoven. That was us.
Crazy, because then we were touring all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being on the road, it's really rough.
Right. And it's also rough, confusing. You're always like, do you turn left? Do you turn right? That is the hard thing about the road.
I know. And you know how I feel about driving. I mean, I didn't learn until after we were on the road. So a lot of times when we were on the road,
we were lost a lot on the road.
We were lost. And I
was a problem.
And I would be like screaming while we were like merging into traffic, because when I merge into traffic, I have to really scream. And I was taking a lot of drugs back then, because being on the road was so
scary. Made you nervous, right?
It made me very, very nervous. Sometimes I didn't even know if I was on the road. Am I dreaming, or are we actually driving on the road? Are we really on the road?
Or maybe we're just blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
Episode. Oh,
yes,
that was something.
Electric.
Well, we did.
Fights.
We did. Our manager, Paul, who took our money,
said
we had to go electric. So we went to your house, and we set up in the driveway, and we didn't really know how to. We're, you know, if you've seen a ukulele, there's
how
no place to really plug it in.
There's no place to plug it in. Yeah, exactly.
So we thought...
We went to the hardware store.
We went to the hardware store.
We bought extension
batteries, extension
everything,
cords.
Everything
no
electric
place
that
to
we
plug
could
it
buy.
In. So you know what we did? We were pretty good students in elementary school. You can make a battery with a baked potato or a raw potato.
A raw potato.
But that was our first mistake, baked, but okay.
Yeah.
At least we didn't go mashed. We got a raw potato, we set up the wires, and we tried to go electric.
We tried to plug the potato into the ukulele.
Then our manager told us, all right, if you can't go electric, you should break some ukuleles on stage. So we're a little afraid of that because of our shoes.
Yes.
We didn't really want to damage our shoes.
I also didn't want to get like a cut because I had read about sepsis.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ukulele disco? You don't remember that?
Yeah.
It was like we were at Studio 54 every night. That was like we were very heavily into that whole scene for a little while, because ukuleles were like, there was this brief moment somewhere around like November 18th to November 20th, 1974, where ukuleles were kind of
And we tried, was it Saturday? No, not Saturday Night. It was Sunday Night Rash.
Sunday Night Rash.
Sunday Night Rash.
Yeah, we tried. We tried. It didn't really, you know, I don't know why. Maybe like it passed its peak at that point. Yeah. People were too busy with, I don't know, Casey and the Sunshine Band.
We couldn't get into some of the discos because of the bouncer.
That's true.
The bouncer didn't let
us in. We were too short.
Yeah, we were too short.
Yeah. And the glasses. I think that was troublesome. We should not have worn the glasses.
Right. And they were always inspecting our... And ukuleles.
For drugs. Because we did used to keep our drugs in the ukulele, along with the gum and the tissues and, you know,
and the
change of underwear.
Pencils,
sketch pads. You could put a little sketch pad in there. You can carry this as a purse.
Yeah. We never broke up. That's probably why we weren't a bigger hit.
Yeah, and I do really hope that we that we peak yet again as ukular, ukular, whichever we decide it's going to be.
Right. Well, we're doing the best we can that doesn't involve work.
We have,
do you want to play
a weemawack? Yeah.
You say weemawack. I say weemaway.
It is weemaway.
I didn't know.
That's wrong.
We didn't know for the longest time what weemaway was. And we still don't. But I had the theory that it's what you do all the doo-dah day.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight.
Chorus. On your mark, get set, go. A whim away,
a whim away, a whim.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first, and it may be the last time. Patty Marks and Roz Chast on vocals and ukulele. The disco ukulele remix is courtesy of Terrence Bernardo. That's it for today. I'm David Remnick. Next week, I'll be talking with another musical icon, a real one this time, Annie Clark, who performs under the name St. Vincent. Please join us. Until then, have a great week.
The end. We're working on some new lyrics for this that was near New Jersey, the great New Jersey. Chris Christie sleeps tonight.
Yeah, because we like being topical.
Yeah, it's important. We have a great rhyme with Obama and pajamas, but we need a story to go with it.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.